This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Julian Ng. We've just come out of this lovely little weekend. And next week, we're looking forward to a long weekend. So Julian, weekends galore. How was your weekend?
It was good, actually. I spent some time yesterday evening in the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Ooh, you're very cultured.
Yes, I was, in fact, forced to go. But at the end of it, it turned out to be a very enjoyable afternoon. There was a performance on all the music from Studio Ghibli, the Japanese studio, which brought us things like Spirited Away and A Graveyard of the Fireflies and Lady Mononoke and
all those animated features.
Amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, I would recommend the MPO to anybody, especially those who, you know, start to say, oh, it's so elitist. And all. In fact, they do so much to make it accessible. And even that dress code thing.
They've discarded with the dress code. You don't need to go with a jacket anymore.
All right. And it used to be, either jacket or, as I used to wear a batik shirt. I wore the same batik shirt every time.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
You can still do that now, but you know, if anyone who feels that they are discouraged to go because they had to wear a jacket, you don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, and anyway, in the past, they would always supply you with an ill-fitting jacket if you needed one. So you went in the afternoon? Was it an afternoon show?
Afternoon, yes. Yeah, and it was very interesting because they discouraged the use of your mobile phones, and when you start using them in the middle of the show, they have this laser thing that they will point at you and your phone, sort of like their way of naming and shaming you, you know. And I think it's a very nice subtle way of asking you to stop using your mobile phone.
Oh, did you see some people being...
Loads of people.
Yeah, I really don't get that about people. You know, you go for a concert, you pay for it, and then you spend half your time looking at your phone.
Because you got to update your Instagram, you know, your Facebook and your Instagram.
You know, the first show I went to, Julian, was a show about trains. So it was...
Trains.
So first half...
At the Philharmonic.
Yeah. So it was music and trains, short films, and then the second half was... the Buster Keaton classic called The General, which is about a runaway train. So, you know, early echoes of Sandra Bullock. And I don't know what it was. What's his name? Who acted with Sandra Bullock in that bus that goes crazy? Do you remember that movie?
Is that Speed?
Yeah, I think it's called Speed.
That
Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves. Anyway, it was brilliant. Buster Keaton, because it's a silent movie, so it's the music that would go accompany a silent movie as well. You know, they had these little orchestras. Yeah, that's so brilliant stuff. Anyway, okay, exciting lineup for you this morning. Julian, you'll be speaking to Dennis Lau. He's the president of the Malaysian Rubber Glove Manufacturers Association with an interesting acronym, MAGMA.
MAGMA, that's right. And I will be exploring what is the growth of the glove making industry amid all these health scares and disease outbreaks, finding out how Zika would, I'm sure, no doubt be quite good for business, but just checking in with him on how that is going. And also, I think everyone's talking about disruption now, and I'm just curious to see whether the glove is a product that's ripe for disruption, right? It's so traditional. You never think of it as something that needs disruption.
Yeah, well, that's a interesting question because it's very basic and you can't really get more basic than that. And it's so necessary, especially in the time of pandemics and, you know, concerns about, infections and contagion. And so I think how would you improve on it unless you produce a new form of human skin?
You know, they've moved from natural rubber to synthetic called nitrile. And nitrile is apparently, by the way, more superior than the natural rubber gloves. And of course, Malaysia, it's all down to whether Malaysia wants to lead the way because we're the biggest exporter of rubber gloves in the world. 80% of the, I think 80, 90% of the world rubber gloves consumption come from Malaysia.
A production.
Billions. We produce billions of gloves every year.
So, okay. And then beyond that, we're going to be looking after the grill, because we have our business talks. And then we are going to be looking at current affairs. Now, the current affairs show, which comes after the breakfast grill, about 8:35, is a look at developments in Sarawak, especially over that deal with Petronas and other kinds of kind of cultural skirmishes that we've had there. We had recent case of a headmaster in a school who didn't allow a student to wear a crucifix or a cross. Mm-hmm. This headmaster, of course, was somebody from the peninsula. Not of course, but was from the peninsula. And I think the Sarawak government has come out to say this is perfectly acceptable.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of these things do come out when people want to forward their own political ideas and I guess to arrive at a situation where you have a kind of political hegemony. Because I think related to this story as well, the Johor Crown Prince scoffs at the One Malaysia, and he moves Bangsa Johor. Now, I think One Malaysia is not necessarily a bad thing. It's to bring people together. But I guess over the years, it's been viewed with a healthy dose of distrust because of what's happening in the government, right? And all the scandals surrounding it. But Bangsa Johor, on the other hand, also not a bad thing. I mean, you're not trying to divide people according to ethnic lines, but really to promote this idea of a very ethnically neutral kind of race. And that's a good thing, right? So, and they're doing it, I suppose, because they want to have power, because Tunku Ismail quoted the fact that Sarawak is very powerful because they are individualist in their approach to the whole thing.
And they've become so assertive.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure to be quoting the Crown Prince of Johor in my discussions with Dr. Andrew Area from UNIMAS about the developments in the state of Sarawak. So look forward to that at about 8:35. Now, today's pressing matters, when we take a look at issues behind the news, and we speak to political scientist Kyle Condict from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And we'll be looking at the U.S. elections, because that's a big one coming up at the end of the year, partly because in the way it's kind of reshaping traditional boundaries of loyalty in the American political system. We all are familiar, of course, with the Republican-Democrat kind of divide. Over the years, they've had third-party candidates. And, of course, we also know that there are other parties. They don't get much attention by the free press of America. Parties like the Green Party, led by Jill Stein, you know, they never get invited to anything big. So you couldn't be blamed if you thought that the contest in America was just between two major parties, the Republicans and Democrats.
Well, in the last, I guess, a few hundred years, it's either one of these two parties that wins the election, isn't it, Sharad? I think there were one or two years where neither the Democratic or the Republican Party won, but that was a very long time ago. But the thing is that the assertion is that the two parties are becoming more and more like each other. And people like, I guess, on both extremes, Donald Trump as well as Bernie Sanders, they have managed to kind of change the conversation about what their parties are all about.
Yeah, and not necessarily in a good way. Melissa Idris will speak to Dr. Condict about the media gurus who are shaping political communication in America. She's also going to be looking at the kinds of dominant narratives in American political discourse. So look forward to that. That's at 9:30, you know, after the opening numbers in the Bursa and such. So let's have a quick look at what's happened in the news, things that are happening around the world and might be of some consequence. Hong Kong has gone to the polls, and it's the first major poll since the pro-democracy protests of 2014. Remember that, the umbrella protests?
Yep.
They were very big. I think some Malaysian activists even went to Hong Kong to participate. I don't know how many, but there's always an excitement about the possibility of change.
Yep.
And we're at the stage where the votes are now being counted. Apparently, some 58% of Hong Kong's 3.8 million registered voters turned out. And this is much higher than the last time they went to vote, which is at 45%, and that was in 2008. So still low considering what's at stake. And you think, you know, in a country like ours where voter turnout numbers tend to be much higher, you know, Hong Kong seems to reflect
For any other country that would be considered apathetic, 58% of the votes, right? But you got to understand that Hong Kong is a very different sort of society. They're not, I guess, not many of them are very politically conscious until they are pushed to the brink, as we saw in the umbrella protests. And there is also the case of China trying to edge their way into the life in Hong Kong, trying to take away a lot of these democratic rights, and therefore a lot of these people are now pushing the needle on election turnout.
Yeah, well, there are two things. One is in many mature democracies, voter participation is reasonably low. I mean, the US is famously kind of hovering around 50% or less.
Yeah.
In terms of voter actually, you know, participation in elections, they spike apparently during the presidential elections, but for all kinds of other, you know, referenda, plebiscites, and you know, votes, elections at different levels of government, they tend to be quite low.
I think political parties are trying to mine the young, because that's, I guess they can influence that through a lot of social media that was not available before traditionally to these parties when they did their media strategy. But today, mm-hmm. you can actually be quite targeted in your approach. And the young, I the umbrella protest in Hong Kong, it was the youth that led the protests with that schoolboy, you know, the college kid who was the iconic figure in those protests. So perhaps there is this revival of political awareness among the youth.
Yeah, well, the other thing was, Julian, is people who say, you know, that, you know, China, Beijing, as it were, is trying to take democratic rights away from Hong Kong, often get pushed back on this argument because they say, well, you know, Hong Kong didn't have democratic rights under the British. And so the only democratic rights people from Hong Kong enjoyed happened on the eve of their incorporation back into the motherland. And so, you know, it's this really weird argument. I mean, it's not like Hong Kong has a long tradition of democratic politics.
Well, some of these things that were agreed, the basic plan, one country, two systems, which ensured certain rights were in place, you know, the right to elect your own leaders, for example, press freedom. And we saw this spate of disappearance of bookstore owners, as well as the taking over of the South China Morning Post, I guess, by Chinese interests, by Alibaba, no less, right? Would seem to suggest that this is moving away from, especially the press freedoms that were available under the British. And Hong Kong is a very pragmatic place. You know, people are constantly thinking about the next idea, about the next way to make money. And as a financial center, that is putting Hong Kong's position as a financial center in question, because there are other places that don't have that autocratic communist veneer over it. Singapore, for example, I mean, you could argue that Singapore could be as communist as China as well, right? If not more sometimes. But how is the future of China's or Hong Kong's position as a financial center going to be compared to Singapore or other places around the region?
Yeah, lots of discuss there. Interesting, Germany, democratic, is producing interesting results, and it's supposed to... sorry, got a bit of the haze still remaining in my chest.
Frog in your throat.
Angela Merkel's Angela Merkel's ruling CDU party has beaten to third place by an anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim party in the northeastern German state. Apparently, Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD, party took 21% of the vote behind the center-left's SPD's 30%. So SPD's won the election there, but AfD took a healthy share, beating Merkel's CDU, which only received 19% of the vote. Germany goes to a key parliamentary election next year in 2017, and these elections are seen as a harbinger of what might come. So anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim party, very disturbing for a government that, you know, and I guess a people that claim to be quite progressive. So
yeah, especially also the fact that German is seen as the leader of the EU. And I guess this takes us back to the kind of disenfranchisement that exists, leading to the support of all these outliers like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. You know, these people being attracted to new ideas, not necessarily good ideas, but new ideas.
Well, I think xenophobia is as old as the Greeks. Yeah, but you're right. A lot of people disenfranchised, perhaps by globalization, and such, and very resentful. And I think, you know, the democratic system is giving them a voice. Well, we'll be right back with more BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and you just heard Baby, It's You by The Beatles. Such soothing sounds for, you know, a group that might have seemed to many of a previous generation as quite menacing. Can you imagine in your 50s and you had teenage children, you were wondering what they were doing, shaking their heads and, you know, and going crazy over, you know, this four-member boy band, you know?
I think that kind of thing is very common, isn't it, even till today?
Absolutely. But I think, you know, these days, parents having, you know, and younger parents, of course, kind of accept that as the norm, don't they? I mean, One Direction, yeah. You know.
Sharad, you're very up to date.
I know, I'm so bad at this.
The latest.
Okay, well, you're listening to Julian and myself, Sharad Kutin. And we're going to be bringing you more news. We were just looking at some of the headlines from the international press. Angela Merkel in Germany, the Hong Kong vote count. That looks like it might be an interesting race. And we should actually look in on who wins and what significance that has for the shape of Hong Kong's future, at least in terms of governance and addressing concerns about democratic rights. I mean, that was the big thing from the 2014 protests. But back at our jobs, and many of us, you know, on our way to work, I don't know how many of us think about how to do our work better. And we have a story. I'm going to tweet out the link, and it's from the World Economic Forum. Julian often attacks it as a tool.
Not necessarily an attack, but more of a suspicion for the World Economic Forum to continue to put us in that. I guess they want to make sure that labor supply continues to crank out workers and continues to, you know, put us in that position where we can work beyond our means to do so.
Yeah, they want us to be more productive. And I think the idea is that
productive makes it sound so positive.
Well, yeah, okay. So they're trying to squeeze
more
the
like
life out
lab
of
lab rats and making us work our posteriors off.
Okay. Well, you know, this story, take it or leave it, but these are seven insights into how to do your work better. But they're saying in this story that these insights aren't based on just kind of, you know, kind of pearls of wisdom that have been tossed about all these, you know, generations, but it's actually based on cognitive science. So, okay, let's take the first one, which says become intentional about your filters, which is very interesting because what they're saying is that the brain has to filter everything. It has to filter actively in order to maintain, you know, your kind of, in some sense, your sanity. And I remember the Oliver Sacks book, you know, the the cognitive scientist, you know, very famous one, who died recently. The book was titled "The Man Who Could Not Forget," and it says not being able to forget becomes a huge burden, a psychic burden on the brain. So the filters are there, and the question is, can you actively shape your filters? Because if you go in, if you had a bad day or you've had a bad morning, and you go into work, and your filters are set at a kind of negative setting, as it were, we can use kind of common language, then you tend to see the world in negative terms. And what this is saying is that you can actually, if you pause and think about how you're approaching your day and your work and your colleagues, you could actually reset your filters for something a little more positive and for which the outcome will be positive. Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that sounds like a lot of baloney to you?
I think that a lot of these things that have been suggested, and there are 7 points here that have been put forward by, you know, the World Economic Forum.
Say that very slowly because it sounds more and more ominous. The World Economic Forum.
I think a lot of these points are quite logical and they make a lot of sense. But you need somebody to actually formalize it and to remind us that... You can actually become better and you can be less stressed out if you take note of some of these points. And I guess filtering is one of them that's quite logical. The other one that's I like is point number 4. If that article has been tweeted out, you can go right to point number 4 and say, stay cool through distancing. And this is where you kind of distance yourself from these negative stimuli that are happening around you. And the article actually suggests asking yourself this question. And this is going to sound very much like, you know, Anthony Robbins in a self-help seminar that you're attending. When I look back on this in a year's time, what will I think? So that's a way of distancing yourself, which I think is beneficial because it really takes you away from the heat of the moment and very much helpful in reducing your stress. And not only that, improving your relationship with the others around you, your colleagues, which is so important, right? Your social skills and social adroitness is something that is so important to make you promote, you know, advance in your career.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that this is prefaced with a reference to the way the brain works. So it begins by saying, when we're feeling uncomfortably stressed, research has found that there's less activity in our prefrontal cortex, that part of our brain responsible for sophisticated reasoning. So, okay, so that's the connection. The idea is that it's the stress stops you from thinking in a sophisticated way. You're more likely to act rash because maybe you have that whole, you know, run or flee, whatever response. Your adrenaline is pumping, you know, you're angry, you're in a state of heightened awareness of a very particular thing rather than an overall picture. And so the idea is that you first have to kind of reduce your stress in order to help your prefrontal cortex kick into action. I love that word, prefrontal cortex. I think that's going to be the word of the day for me.
Yeah, I think you should just bandy these words around even if you don't know what it means. It just makes you sound smarter, slightly smarter. Prefrontal cortex. How's your prefrontal cortex today?
Yeah.
Also, I think, Sharad, many times when we are in a meeting and the focus is on our work and what we do, we tend to take it down to a very personal level in the sense that a criticism about our work is a criticism of ourself, our you know, state of being, which is, I think, very damaging to the whole idea of getting the best products out, right? Getting the best stuff, best work.
Why is that?
Because it's not about you.
It's not only about you, right? It's about a whole range of things. Some of which you're not in control of.
I mean, there are commercial imperatives, right? Just imagine Steve Jobs coming in to say something bad about the iPhone. And of course, Steve Jobs is not alive anymore. But just imagine...
Speaking from the grave.
From the grave. telling you that, hey, this iPhone does not look good. And you take it personally. It would be very hard to get something like the iPhone out. And I think that... we should not conduct meetings like that, taking it down to a personal level. And in fact, I think we, in fact, should open ourselves up to critique without getting personal about
it. Okay, I do think, I mean, the thing I appreciate about articles like this is the bottom line is being self-aware. Whether you base on science or you base it on, you know, something your mentor said to you when you first started out work or whatever it is, the point is the level of self-awareness is always, a heightened level of self-awareness is good in dealing with a part of your life that is that dominates it, right? I mean, you're spending at least a third of your day at your job.
Of your life, in fact, of your waking hours. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and so when you add it up, you think, well, you know, if you can approach it in a way that makes you a calmer person, I'm not talking about, you know, this having any kind of effect on the bottom line for the company, but your personal bottom line, your well-being, you know, not just your salary. Anyway, we'll be picking up these stories and more after the news, and we're coming up to the bulletin of the first bulletin of the day with Keith Kam, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run. That was Don't Let Me Down by The Wonder Stuff. A band from the 80s, I'm told. I don't actually remember them, and I'm from the 80s, but then I wasn't really very musical in my youth.
Also, I think there were like so many kinds of music in the 80s. I was mainly of the persuasion of the Brit school of, you know, the Brit pop. And I shunned and eschewed anything that was American.
Ah, well, they're British, this group. The one
haven't heard of them.
Yeah, they're what they called a alternative British alternative rock group from the West Midlands. Okay, anyway.
We've got a lot of hipster music directors who put this kind of music in.
I love the music that we play on BFM. Not everybody does. Okay, we've been reading, and we've been reading The Guardian recently. Apparently, there's an article in The Guardian that makes this passionate call for banning meat in the national health system. So you can't get cigarettes, and they say meat. And basically, the article, which does sound like it's written by a vegan, goes on to note that British people are really odd because a large number of them, like in the high 90s, call themselves animal lovers, but then also eat animals. Now, for somebody of this persuasion, that seems ridiculous. How could you love animals and then eat them? And I remember, you know, a menu in Chiang Mai. I went to Chiang Mai like 20, 30 years ago, and it was a vegetarian restaurant. It says, you know, love animals, don't eat them. And so clearly these guys all think alike. I don't see the problem. I think you can love an animal and still eat it.
Yeah, I think you need to eat for survival. And I'm sure that many tribal societies who would worship the animal before they eat them. You just need to eat to survive, right? But this here
is. Do you need eat meat? I mean, a lot of vegetarians will tell you don't need meat.
Good question. Good point. Which is the point of this article, in fact, which says that cigarettes are banned under the National Health Service of the United Kingdom, but not meat, and both cause cancer. So why is one allowed and the other not?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of contradictions, I guess, in our lives, and this article points out to the many ways in which we justify our own practices. It says people say to themselves, even animal lovers, and maybe especially animal lovers will say, pets are different from farm animals. You know, that's one way of making to distinguish your love. You love your pets and you love to eat lamb, you know, or mutton or whatever, you know. And that, in fact, and some people even make arguments that are quasi-religious, they will say, well, you know, animals will put on planet Earth to, or part of creation, in order to supply us food. And so we should not deny this bounty.
To that, you should read this book called Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, who's a professor in a university in Israel, who says that the greatest animal extinction coincided with the rise of the Homo sapiens. We, in fact, at the dawn of our evolution, we killed everything in our wake.
We just didn't know what we were doing. We didn't realize what we were doing.
We still don't.
We didn't have a global view of things.
I think we still don't.
Well, you know, I mean, I think this is fascinating because today they are received wisdoms. I mean, or there is the new normal, if you like to call it that. People, we think that this is how life should be, and we project back into the past, and we assume that our ancestors, you know, thought or should think like we do. And I don't know if that's true. I mean, we know that, you know, people around the world still don't all hold similar views and values.
Well, I think it's interesting that you raised that, because there is another story from The Guardian as well about how ancient Egyptian works are to be published together in English for the first time. And the background of the story is that whenever you go to a museum and look at Egyptian hieroglyphics, all you get is some very murky translation and interpretation of that. In fact, a lot of times you just see the papyri and not actually understand what those things are saying. And
yeah, now it becomes kind of decorative, doesn't it?
Exactly. So now they're translating that to works. And you'd be surprised to learn that the kind of hardships and existentialist questions that those guys face are very similar to what we face today. For example, one of the stories here, I was here with my brothers and my children. We totaled 75 snakes. Then a star fell and they were consumed in flames. If you're brave and your heart is strong, you will embrace your children, you will kiss your wife, and you will see your house. I mean, it sounds like the kind of tips that the World Economic Forum would peddle out, right?
I know you're trying to discredit the World Economic Forum there. But yeah, but how many of us kind of, you know, go out and find snakes? Oh, except those Pokemon hunters. They're constantly finding all
the
kinds of...
The snakes are a symbol of trouble and problems, right? And we have our own snakes to bear today.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's absolutely true that in many ways things haven't changed for humankind. We still struggle with the same sort of pains, the grief of somebody, a loved one dying. And in fact, some of the more ancient archaeological sites, you know, of human habitation, note graves and graves, you know, with flowers to suggest that people were buried and there was some ritual. I mean, that's never changed. That's never going to change in some ways, I think. It is fascinating to kind of jump into the minds of ancients and then and discover things about them. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in Bagan, which is in sort of central Myanmar, many years ago, about 10 years ago. And Julian, recently they were, you know, many of these pagodas were destroyed by the earthquake there. But in one of them is one of the biggest temples. There's a Nanda complex. You know, many of the icons are all about the Buddhist stories, the Jataka stories, but which I don't really understand. But in a little ashram nearby, there were murals, just paintings from, and this is from like the 11th century. And it's just of people sitting on a bench.
Beautiful.
And dogs running about, and you know, and it's just daily life from 1,000 years ago, which could be daily life today, and so quite extraordinary.
Exactly. Yeah, except that the daily life today would be 8 hours in the office, around surrounded by a cubicle, and having to attend meetings.
Well, but you know, but most of humanity, 1,000 years, they weren't just having a good time either. I mean, if you were helping build the pyramids, you were, you know, a slave, or if you
exactly
if you were in the farm and you were tilling the soil.
I guess a lot of these stories that appear on the Egyptian papyri and the hieroglyphs would be about a certain class of people, right? The stories would reflect that more affluent class, and they would not...
Or the ruling class, yeah.
Exactly, not be writing about the slaves. Like, this is another one. I mean, I love this story because it takes us back to the dawn of civilization, and it tells us how their stories are like the same as ours. This was a letter written by a farmer to, I guess, his steward. Be extra dutiful in cultivating. Watch out that my barley seed is guarded. I think this is, there's some sense of a very modernist, modern day issue with this story, right?
Okay, right. So he's reading the World Economic Forum and he's picking up tips on how to oppress his workers. Is that what you're reading?
Oh, it's not about oppression. I'm sure he values the work of his steward, because this guy is away on business, travel, and his business is his steward is the only one he can rely on, and he's kind of worried about what's happening at home.
Julian, have you read the work of Amitav Ghosh? He was the author of The Glass Palace, which is that sweeping novel that takes you from Burma to Malaya and all that. Anyway, he's got a very old book now. It's called In an Antique Land. And much of the work of that is based on documents that were found in a Jewish synagogue, right? So in the synagogue, when a letter is written, whatever, and the name of God is invoked in a letter, mm-hmm. You can't discard it willy-nilly. You have to burn it in a ritual fashion. So this is a Jewish custom. And what happened in this particular synagogue was that all these documents piled up in what was like an incinerator, but they didn't get burnt. And so hundreds of documents were left unburnt, and then they found their way. Later, they were discovered, and they started to be sold. And so they entered into the trade of, you know, antique texts and stuff. And Amitav Ghosh talks about the conversations being held, the conversation between two individuals at a particular time. And he goes back and forth in time, and it's fascinating. Again, you know, like in this case, you mm-hmm. know, between a farmer and his steward, there was between a slave owner and his slave, because this time his slave is actually a man of learning,
yeah.
right? And so, you know, stepping back into time, and, you know, I love that book, In an Antique Land. I'd recommend it to anybody.
Oh, excellent. Maybe you should tweet that out later.
Oh, I could do that, yeah. Amitav Ghosh, I believe he's got a new book out that's just come out very recently. So, and looking at the issue of globalization and climate change. Very, very important things. We have tweeted out the link to the Guardian story, and I'm going to tweet out the link to the Amitav Ghosh story. Now, coming up before the news, we have a song by Badfinger, Come and Get It. And after that, we have the news at 7 o'clock.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.